From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. You heard it yesterday, July 4th, but there's no reason not to listen again. It's easy to say that John Philip Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever is an American composition. But because music is abstract, the elements that make it American are hard to define. I mean, is it the subject matter, our flag, that makes it American? Is it Sousa's provenance, the son of German and Spanish immigrants, that liberates him from any rules of what a march should sound like? Is it the martial nature of the piece itself, or the sheer enthusiasm of its expression? Where do you hear the essence of America in this piece of music? For that matter, what is the American sound? That's what we're talking about in this hour on Point, listeners. Is there an essential American sound? When did the U.S. free itself from its European musical roots and develop its own form of musical expression? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Joining me in the studio to help us search for the origins of this sound, it's hard to read to this music, you do want to take off. R. Mac Glaser, the chair of the strings department of Berklee School of Music in Boston, and musical director of the group The Wayfaring Strangers. Good evening, Matt.
How are you doing?
And Charles Schadel, classical composer and lecturer in music at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome
Hello.
To you, Charles. Okay. We're listening. Charles, what is the essential American character of this?
Well, I think part of this is simply the sound we hear. The wind band sound is a really characteristic aspect of 19th century music. We were a land with very few orchestras, but every little town in America in the 19th century had a village band. And Sousa is sort of the ultimate version of this kind of sound world.
And marches. Now, I mean, the march was... It became something known as American. I mean, it wasn't, didn't start out as an American form of expression.
Not at all. I mean, this is essentially a European form. Its shapes and forms are European. Its harmony is conventional European harmony. In Stars and Stripes Forever, though, you do get some of that characteristic American rhythmic quality. There's a certain amount of at least syncopation.
Syncopation, swing. Matt, do you hear this piece swing?
I'm listening. Swing, as defined by Gunther Schuller, is the balance of elements between the vertical and horizontal elements of music. Now, that's a fairly technical description, but it's swinging in that it's capturing my body, and my body wants to move.
It's very much music of the body. I mean, it is a march. You want to move to this.
What do you think the origins are of that journey towards an American sound?
Well, we were talking about it, Charles and I, earlier. It's whatever we say in this hour is not even going to, in his words, begin to scratch the surface. You could get any 20 musicians in a room and spend a century arguing about this and describing the various streams. And that's what, to me, makes it so compelling. You could spend your life studying any one of these idioms that have fused and created the American sound, this patchwork, this quilt. And you could look at it from any one of different vantage points. You know, while a certain level of American socioeconomic level was listening to John Philip Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever, other music was happening in poor white churches and in black churches and in various other groups of people that is completely different than that and sounds very different. For instance, the evolution of shape note singing in southern white churches.
What is shape note singing?
Well, shape note singing is a kind of prehistoric form of solfege in which
solfege.
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Mm-hmm. In which you'd look at your book and there'd be a triangle that would indicate the fourth note of the scale or the fifth note of the scale, and you could line out these songs. So what we're going to listen to now is the great hymn, Amazing Grace, as performed by Ralph Stanley and the Clinch Mountain Boys. And he lines it out. He sings the first line, and then the rest of the guys come in and respond to him. He sings the next line, they respond. And you'll hear immediately an improvisational character, an approach to this beautiful song that we all know so well, as well as a frightening rural sensibility.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. That saved a wretch like me.
I was lost, but now I'm found.
I once was lost, but now I'm found.
Was blind, but now I see.
Was blind, but now I see.
Matt, it gives you chills, but I mean, it's call and response. Did that originate here, or did that they bring that from whatever small Protestant congregation came over from Scotland and went up a holler?
No, I think it came from the interaction, I mean, this is speculation, but interaction of Celtic music traditions with black music traditions, that some people came over here voluntarily and a whole group of people were brought over here against their will, living in close proximity, and their cultures fused. And to me, that's what is continually fascinating about American music, is this cross-pollinization of peoples who are living close to one another, creating new styles which fuse again with other styles and create new styles.
It seems to me that's almost how we define American music. That may be its unique trait, that it is a combination of so many other elements, and I don't think we see that in many other music cultures.
Wow. It's a constant resynthesizing of whatever you come in contact
absolutely.
With.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Harmonically, what is happening here?
This is music that is basically part of a European harmonic tradition, but it has raw edges. The musicians are being guided not just by how they know music should work. They're also being guided by how it sounds right to them, how the expressive quality of the text and the tune can react with the harmony.
Classical composers are very aware of the value of folk traditions. The great Béla Bartók is known to us as a composer, but he spent most of his life energy as an ethnomusicologist going around villages and collecting songs. And he said that folk music expresses a musical idea more perfectly and densely than any other style of music he can imagine, with nothing wasted, absolute purity and density. So these guys are part of autochthonous, from the earth tradition. Ralph Stanley's roots go back deep into the mountains, the Appalachian Mountains, and so he's expressing the emotional life and the spiritual life of a group of people more purely than anything else. It's not academic music, it's music from the earth, and luckily for us right now, Americans are rediscovering this vast resource that we have.
There was a sort of rediscovery of this music, too, though, in the 30s, when a lot of so-called classical composers became very interested. One thinks of Virgil Thompson and Henry Cowell, Copland himself, who were very interested in this, actually, and the harmonic world and the melodic world of this music. It pointed new directions that didn't seem to be part of a sort of effete 19th century tradition.
What about the actual production of the voice? Do you hear that? I mean, anywhere in Europe, or is that also something that just kind of emerged in West Virginia or the Blue Ridge Mountains?
You know what they say about bluegrass music, sung from the heart through the nose.
That's that's exactly right. But I mean, the nasal production of the voice, I mean, where did that come from?
Well, you know, if you listen to mountain music from around the world, you discover that there are similarities in mountain music produced from various regions around the world, that singing in this style sounds closer to Turkish music than it does to opera singing. Now, why that is the case, I cannot.
There's also some suggestion, just that as sort of the pronunciation of southern dialects may reflect 17th century English, it may have been that, you know, 17th century, say at the court of Charles I, you would have heard singing using a vocal production not unlike this. So some scholars have suggested this is a sort of ancient survival.
Well, let's go back to the country's origins. And what was the music like at the time of the Revolution? Would it have had this nasal quality? Would it have been just borrowed tavern songs from the mother country, England?
Well, yes, a lot of the music would have been brought from England. This style of vocal production would have probably been rather common. But by the middle of the 18th century, America starts to produce and even publish its own music. And we're listening to a piece by a Boston composer, William Billings, his sort of great anthem of the American Revolution, Chester. And it's part of the singing school tradition. And there weren't that many sort of social events where men and women could meet in the Puritan New England of that time. And these gatherings where you went and learned all of this music served an important social function as well.
Well, you know, that really does sound like it could have come straight out of any English church, or actually, given the nature of the tune, and any fight song from an old English public school.
Yes, and there is a lot of similarity. Chester, in some ways, is more regular, I think we'd say, than some of them. Billings uses a lot of harmonic devices, things we call parallel fifths, that Handel would have been horrified by. But certainly the melody is very much part of a sort of Anglo-Saxon tradition.
So, I guess one of the things I'd like to get at is, well, first of all, I'm going to give out the phone number. We're talking, as you can tell, about the origins of American music. We're looking to find out what is the pure American sound, and I'm talking with Matt Glaser, who is a teacher at Berklee College of Music. It's Charles Shader, who's a lecturer at MIT here in Boston. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to join in the conversation. But the conversation I want to get around to is, you know, there's this moment, right, where you learn in college, right? Mark Twain's the first really American voice in fiction. He's like, he synthesizes all that's out there. Is there a similar mid-19th century figure who kind of like suddenly becomes the American guy?
I think we've tend to put that burden a little later in music, perhaps on Charles Ives. But, you know, when you sort of pick this bellwether figure, it usually means that you've ignored a lot of other people to do so.
But, I mean, is Stephen Foster the one? I mean, populism being so much a part of what American culture is, I mean, there's always an argument between high culture and low culture. Well, in America, pop culture is our culture in many ways. I mean, would Stephen Foster be part of it?
I think certainly the influence of Foster, and we all know this music, and in fact, it's music that seems to have a universal appeal.
Matt, now you're in folk music. I mean, was Stephen Foster already kind of making commercial hay out of folk work?
Well, let's say I bristle at the epithet folk musician, although I play traditional music and I'm interested in various, for lack of a better word, folk tradition, ethnic traditions, jazz, improvisational music. These melodies are built incredibly strongly, and there's something essentially American about these songs, and they've been treated by everyone. Earlier today, I was listening to a record of Louis Armstrong and the Mills Brothers doing this, which has level upon level of irony because some of the words are quite racist. So here are these four black guys swinging their behinds off on Swanee River. To me, this is more essentially American, taking Stephen Foster, which is American, then subjecting it to levels and levels of perversity, irony, and other things.
I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
Round the little farm I wandered when I was young. Then many happy days I squandered, many the songs I sung. When I was played with my brother, happy was I. My kind old mother, there let me live and die.
I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking about the American sound, where it comes from, trying to pick apart the abstract notion of music and trying to find what is American in Appalachian Spring. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to join in the conversation and to ask questions of my guests, Matt Glazer and Charles Schadel, both of whom teach music here in the Boston area. Charles, now this is taken from a Shaker hymn.
Right.
The composer was Jewish. He's from Brooklyn, trained in Paris. Yet when you hear the strings underpinning that bit of music that we've had here, people hear that and they weep because they think it's America. You put it in a commercial with an American flag, people buy your product.
We seem to feel that it has a sense of kind of American space, of vastness. The way the chord itself is voiced, the sort of instruments are very large distances apart from each other, and it seems a sort of metaphor for American environment.
Well, you're a composer. I mean, that kind of metaphorical thinking would inform a composer's work.
Oh, absolutely. Certainly, and now this is how we evoke an American landscape, be it in film, music, or television. We go for that Copland sound, those very wide-spaced chords, sort of unmixed sonorities. In a lot of European music, instruments double each other and blend together, but we tend to like a sort of pure color, at least in Copland's music.
Copland was influenced by these folk traditions. You know, yesterday you might have heard Bonaparte's Retreat, which is an American fiddle tune that he uses in what's now known to everyone as the beef commercials.
Right. Rodeo.
And
Rodeo.
Copland got a recording from the Library of Congress of the fiddler Luther Strong playing Bonaparte's Retreat. He transcribed it, and basically, note for note, it's what the violins are attempting to play in that piece. So drawing upon the real existent folk traditions as a way of creating an indigenous American classical music.
And Copland very often uses those sort of traditional melodies as a basis. Then the sort of full knowledge of European modernism sort of often takes over, and he treats them in very sophisticated ways, but they are the building blocks.
You know, it's funny. I mean, it's a gift to be simple. This is hardly, in symphonic terms, it's a fairly simple arrangement. But what one struggles to ever think what it might sound like in an a cappella choir of Shakers singing this, you know, at the end of the day when they're worshiping.
It sort of suggests simplicity rather than being simple. Mm. I think that's one of the things that Copland does so beautifully.
Filling out the pay scale for all the musicians involved is not a simple process in a composition like this. The W-2 forms.
But I am serious. I mean, you know, this was a tune that was originally probably sung without any instrumental.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
And you know, let's talk a bit more about mountain songs. They have become very popular, and we often hear them in these overings. I mean, we're going to hear in a second, I think, Joe Stafford singing.
Great, beautiful pop and jazz singer, one of the great singers. She also was married to a wonderful musician who wrote an arrangement of American folk songs for her. And this is a nice transition because the string writing in this is very, very Copeland-esque. It's a beautiful, simple vocal rendition of this song, Shenandoah, which we all think of as one of the great American songs. Another song about place and location. As soon as you put on Copeland for me, I imagine I'm in an airplane flying over Iowa or something, and just that sense of physical space that Charles was talking about is an incredible thing. So you hear that in the strings. Mm-hmm. Some moving voices against the drone.
Mm-hmm.
And then this just incredibly heartfelt.
Oh, Shenandoah, I long to see.
What is some of the history of this song? We sing, you know, did you sing it in fourth grade? I had to sing it.
Oh,
in
I think
grade.
So.
But I mean, where does it come from? I mean,
I do not know.
I don't know either. I have read that it was apparently a sort of a sea song. It was used as a sea shanty. But it seems to have spread sort of almost everywhere.
There's a new album by the jazz pianist Keith Jarrett, The Melody at Night with You, and it starts with a rendition of Shenandoah. To me, this is purely cinematic music. As soon as I hear it, I'm back in some classic black-and-white movie from the 1940s, a woman in a beautiful gingham dress singing something heartfelt. And to me, this is the best of some kind of vision of what it means to be an American.
Well, and with Stafford, who I think is one of the great American singers.
Incredible.
I mean, the versatility of this woman is just staggering.
Mm. Nice arrangement, too.
Mm. I put it on in my apartment this morning and I started to cry. It just...
Matt, go ahead.
Well, you know, there are different ways to view all of this stuff, and once again, to reaffirm that anything we talk about, by default, we're leaving out 1,000 other things. But you can begin, I often like to take, rather than a historical view of this stuff, a kind of existential view, trying to look for some musical and emotional resonance between seemingly disparate styles of music. Is there something that's essentially American? How could there be something essentially American in a country as vast as this with all these different people? But you pointed out one of the things would be a synthetic quality. Another thing might be this something slightly ironic, or that's one thing, a heartfelt feeling of simple beauty. These are all components. So I thought it would be interesting to take some music that's very, very unrelated to one, pieces that are unrelated to one another, and see if we can find any of this emotional resonance. So to start with, I thought we might play, for me, one of the great American sounds is the sound of the fiddle and the banjo, an Appalachian sound played in Appalachian mountains. Here's a tune called Sally Coming Through the Rye by a young old-time fiddler named Raina Gellert. Let's listen to it. Immediately has a dark quality, and in certain respects, this sounds like Turkish music or music you hear in Tibet. It's pure mountain music, rural, mysterious music. It's a tune that probably originated in Scotland or Ireland, but the Scottish and Irish versions of this tune would sound and feel completely different. This feeling comes from the intermingling of the Celtic music with black music.
There's also that thing we remind ourselves, the immigrant experience is a great thing. Grandma came on, and grandfathers came, and look at how wonderful we are today. But I think people forget that certainly in the 18th century, when when the great wave of immigration from what's now Northern Ireland, from Ulster and from Scotland came, it wasn't because people were happy to leave. Mm. Yeah. They left because they had no other option. Mm. And the darkness that you hear, one wonders if there's a certain kind of bitterness that runs through the soul at having to be taken away, forced to leave, and, you know, forced off the land in the case of Scotland, when wealthy landlords forced the Highlanders out and they ended up a holler, as it were.
I just hear the music of the holler. I hear that sound of nature, of the mountains, something mysterious. This is not urban music. But far away, okay, so we're in Appalachia. Far away in Kansas City, many years later, you could have a similar minor tune with a certain sense of groove. This music might have been played for dancing, what we're listening to now. Let's listen to some other Black American music played for dancing. About the same tempo, in a minor tonality. But now we're urban music. Count Basie playing Topsy. Powered by the rhythm guitar of Freddie Green, who played with Basie for 60 years, never took one solo, never had a microphone. People have said about Count Basie's music that it was the severest physical thrill they've ever had the first time they heard Basie play live. You open up. So what's similar to that? Is there any American resonance? Possibly, possibly not. We've taken a cut 3,000 miles from the mountains of Appalachia up to Kansas City. Okay, now let's fuse these two things, American fiddle music and swing, and go down to Texas and listen to Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. A little bit speeding up of the tempo, major tonality, old-time fiddling with a swing feel.
You ought to see my blue-eyed Sally. She lives way down on Shinbone Alley. The number on the gate is the number on the door. And the next time.
And instead of the rhythm section swinging, they're playing like a polka beat. So in Texas, you had German and Polish immigrants. You had Mexican musicians bringing mariachi music, swing music on the radio, and some of the same Appalachian fiddling, except with a much more dry and dusty, open Texas feel.
Taking a musical tour through the history of American music. On Point listeners, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Call. We have two experts to tell us a bit about. We've been talking about roots and jazz, and we'll get over to the classical side, and we can try and parse the difference between high art and dance. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK.
If you think rap musicians invented this, listen to the words here.
Sitting in the window, singing
on one note. Some kind of verbal thing happening rhythmically. Except this would be for square dancing. It feels like Texas to me, this music. Country fiddlers playing swing solos. I love this bizarre amalgam of all these styles. There's something perverse about it and essentially American in my way of looking at things.
You know, it's interesting in the first two pieces that we heard, there's a real sense of tragedy in this music. And I think that's a quality that a lot of times we think is sort of part of a high art tradition. But I don't think that's true. I mean, it gets to sort of, you know, basic human emotions. And this music is full of that. And I think sometimes when classical composers have gone into this tradition, it is simply because it seems that these emotions are so accessible through this kind of music.
I agree 100%. I mean, not particularly in this cut is just kind of...
Well, yes, exactly. Exactly.
But this is a basic human emotion of joy, simple joy and happiness. We live in a culture that has been unable to express simple joy any longer for some reason.
Stay all night, stay a little longer, dance all night, dance a little longer, pull off your coat, throw it in the corner, I don't see why don't stay a little longer.
All right, I'll stay a little longer. No, we'll hear it again. I don't want to talk. That's kind of fun. Charles, but I've mentioned a couple of things, but now let's talk a bit about the. Here you have the roots music, and it is an amalgamation. But there is this thing in American culture. It's not just in music. I mean, it's in across the forms of artistic expression, a kind of suspicion and reticence about elevating something to high art if it loses touch with the popular.
Absolutely.
But, yeah.
I mean, the sort of democracy and art are a very difficult and unusual mix. And I think sort of the history of art in America is a constant negotiation between what is extraordinary by nature and yet still is going to reflect a culture that values the sort of democratic ideal.
Mm. In your own work, I mean, when you teach composition, do you take the abstraction and say that this teach your students how to use the tonal palette to evoke emotion?
Yes, I try to do that. A lot of what we do is a sort of purely technical thing. You begin with learning basic skills. But I think anyone who wants to be a composer, surely that's the direction that they want to go, is you know, to evoke and express emotions and to speak to one's culture. I mean, that seems essentially what we do.
Hmm. So, we're coming up to the break, and we've been dealing in this section with a lot of popular stuff and the mosaic nature of things. And I don't mean mosaic in the religious term, but mosaic in terms of putting lots of pieces of the puzzle together. Now, here's a mosaic piece. It invokes in our minds the sense of patriotism and keeping the Union together. But it is jazz.
Battle Hymn of the Republic, performed by Clark Terry and Bob Brookmeyer. A black man and a white man playing together with their tongues in their cheek. If it's messy, and it has too many things to even say in one sentence, it's American. All these bizarre components thrown together.
I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. Michael Goldfarb, this is On Point. This is American music also. Putnam's Camp is the second movement of Three Places in New England by Charles Ives, performed by the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Charles Schadl, tell us a bit about this piece.
This is Ives evoking the sort of magical world of his childhood. He was the son of a Civil War era band director, and his father had a fascinating sort of experimental approach to music. A famous story of taking his young son up to the steeple of the church tower on the town common and having four bands march in to the town square playing completely different music. It's a sort of experimental kind of music. Ives is one of those American artists that that we treasure because they remind us of other great American figures, you know, like Edison. He seems to be an inventor of genius.
His contemporary. But when this, yes, when this music came out, did people actually say, now we have found our American composer? This is the man.
No, they never heard it. This piece was not heard until almost 25 years after Ives composed it. There was a sort of enthusiasm for Ives by the very end of his life, beginning in the 1940s. But this music was not heard during his own lifetime. It was simply beyond the pale.
Mm. Well, in that respect, I suppose it's truly American, since an American artist doesn't live a life of neglect.
To me, he always represents this, the American iconoclast, some eccentric autodidact. I guess his life was that he was worked in the insurance business.
Oh, absolutely. He made millions of dollars in insurance and had a tremendous impact on the modern insurance industry. But the music was so precious to him, and the sort of depth of the
expression. But as you listen to it now, just musicologically, I mean, is there something uniquely American in it?
Yes.
I think absolutely.
There is this collage. We've used the word mosaic before going on, and no other music before this had ever sort of attempted to have so many disparate things going on simultaneously. You hear marches, you hear Foster-like melodies, sometimes actual tunes, hymn tunes, any sort of music that Ives can come across that's part of a sort of New England transcendentalist view of the world must be present in the music.
His good friend Carl Ruggles was a similarly inclined American iconoclastic New England composer, and I heard a story once that a piece of Carl Ruggles was being played and Ives was in the audience and some people started to walk out, and Ives stood up in the middle of the concert and started to berate these people. Get back to your seat. Sit down and use your ears like a man.
Oh, Ives absolutely equates dissonance with virility. There's no doubt about it. He's very clear in his essays that, you know, real men like dissonant music.
That makes a good T-shirt or bumper sticker.
Absolutely. We could market it.
I wonder how I would have felt about being stuck in traffic next to a guy who's got his bass cranked up to mega decibels. I'm not sure he'd have agreed.
Oh, he would have had to have incorporated it into
He would have incorporated it, exactly.
It would have been transformed.
But in this sense, you know, the iconoclastic American genius, there in popular music, too, there were people like Bill Monroe or Bob Wills who fused elements of seemingly unrelated musics together and by the force of their will and personality created new styles. I mean, this is something that is a classically American idea, the American musical genius who, against all odds, creates something extraordinary.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, after all, art is of no use to Americans. So any American artist sort of has to fight for that, you know, that tiny space, that tiny bit of audience.
Well, let me ask you, here's an interesting question. One of the things, coming back to the notion of high art and so on, Leonard Bernstein died thinking he had never composed a great, serious piece of work. And yet we listen to any number of his pieces and thrill to them, and they're quite wonderful. Is it necessary, as a composer, to think in terms, if I work in symphonic forms, that puts me at a different level than Bill Monroe, who works, you know, with a mandolin and some folk roots forms?
Well, I mean, obviously, there are real differences in I sort of hate it when we compare classical music or roots music or jazz music, because they're in dialogue with each other all the time.
Mm. Much more in America, I think, than perhaps in Europe.
Yes, I think that is true.
Hmm.
Certainly the jazz component is one of our musics in a way that it isn't elsewhere.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Dana is on the line.
Good evening.
Hello.
Hi. I just have a... I'm a musician, for what it's worth. And I love Charles Ives, and I love a bluegrass band called Crabgrass, Ellington, Coltrane, and Leonard Bernstein. I mean, I like... But I just have a question about the whole premise of the program is, why do we have to find something that... Why do we have to find this common resonance? Why do we have to nationalize this music? It seems so subjective and capricious and, like...
That is a perfectly good question, Dan.
Yeah.
Because we needed a premise for our program is what it comes to. No, the truth is that you do think, is there some essence, something essential that you can put your hand on? Is there a chord? Is there a single chord that you hear and you say, well, that's an American chord?
Yeah, Dana, are you on the line?
Yes.
Dana, haven't you ever heard a piece of music and you think to yourself, gee whiz, that's such an American sound? Have you ever thought that when you've heard something? That sounds so American to me.
Not really, no.
No.
I mean, maybe Charles Ives, if anybody, because of, after what I, you know, he inspired me to read Thoreau and Emerson. But, you know, the music of Charles Ives. And sometimes I do hear his music during the Wellfleet Parade on the 4th of July. And, you know, and that's my favorite holiday, the 4th. But I just think, I don't know, especially these days, we Americans tend to have an overinflated view of ourselves. And
I'd like to have an inflated view, not an inflated view, I'd like to have a view of myself as an American based upon what I value in America. Like when I hear Ralph Stanley singing, I mean, to me, that's something great about America as opposed to what I might be being fed. Or here's Ray Charles. I mean, to me, that's what it means to be an American is Ray Charles, man.
Dana, thanks for your call. And thanks also to our other callers. I'm sorry we weren't able to get to you. Now,
Ray Charles doing the Stephen Foster tune.
Layers upon layers. I thought we were going to be able to define the American chord, and what we found out is that the defining thing is amalgamation.
Absolutely.
Synthesis.
Yes.
Syncopation.
Synthesis, I don't think for American composers or musicians, is an artificial thing.
Mm.
It's simply how we have to function in this kind of society.
I'm not going to talk too long over Ray Charles. Thank you, Matt Glaser.
Thank you.
Berklee College of Music. Thank you, Charles Shader.
Thank you.
Lecturer of Music at MIT. You can carry on the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on the forums. In a moment, Jack Beatty and I are going to look back at this week's news. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of the week.
Obviously, if we're prepared to veto the Bosnia resolution because of our interests with respect to the ICC, clearly it is a very, very important question for the United States.
There was one engagement ceremony, an engagement celebration going on, and that house was hit by several rockets. People in attendance said at least 25 people were killed there and many more injured.
This morning at 11:30, male individual armed with a gun opened fire in the ticket line at El Al. Inside Tom Bradley Terminal.
The folks here did endure the heat. Heat index of above 100 all day. They endured lines, bag searches, and security checkpoints. But now they're enjoying what they came here for.
The New York Times is quoting a person familiar with the plan. He says tens of thousands of Marines and soldiers would probably invade from Kuwait. Hundreds of warplanes based in as many as 8 countries would unleash a huge air assault against thousands of targets, including airfields and communication centers.
Many have urged me to stay, but all have told me to follow my heart and follow my conscience. That's what I'm doing today in announcing my retirement from Congress.
I was a lucky guy because I lived 2 blocks from the ballpark. I had 5 playgrounds around me that I could run to, and I wanted to do it so badly.
The voice of the great Ted Williams is the last news story of this week. Sad story. We also heard about the United States' decision to withdraw American soldiers, possibly from a Bosnian peacekeeping mission, unless they are granted immunity from the International Criminal Court. An American warplane tragically kills dozens of civilians at a wedding in Afghanistan. July 4th shooting at Los Angeles International Airport, two killed at the LL airport counter. Americans had a good time on the 4th. It was a hot time in Boston. The New York Times reports on further military planning for a strike against Saddam Hussein. And J.C. Watts, Oklahoma representative, retires from the House. He will not be seeking re-election. Jack Beatty, for a week of holiday, it wasn't without its newsworthiness.
No, it wasn't. Beginning with the U.S. decision to the threat to withdraw our peacekeepers from the Balkans if they're subject to the restrictions of the internet, if they're made to come under the International Criminal Court. You know, the merits of this aside, it really shows how very little has changed in Bush's worldview since September 11th. I mean, right after, people were saying he's discovered multilateralism. Well, you are in today's world either with Bush's America or against it. He calls himself a simple man, and he has found a simple formula.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is that this was going to be a decision that was going to be made on Wednesday, and now they've delayed it till July 15th. I imagine there'll just be a lot more discussion going on. But we're still on a war footing, it seems, and then there was a tragic accident of war, Jack.
Yes, there was. 150 people killed and wounded at a wedding ceremony. The Pentagon says there was an anti-aircraft gun there. The people say no. A young boy wounded with shrapnel who lost his mother saw an American journalist coming. He said, "I am scared. They are Americans, and they bombed us." And, you know, we have now, I think, exceeded in the number of civilian killed in Afghanistan, the number of Americans killed on September 11th. And we have to ask ourselves, as we hear that we're going to be bombing perhaps thousands of targets in Iraq, how many more kids are going to be saying they are Americans and they bombed us?
It's interesting about the Iraq news. Not for the first time in the last 7 or 8 months, something has appeared on the front page of the New York Times of a deeply speculative nature about a strike against Saddam Hussein. What is that about?
Well, you know, I went back over the piece, and my guess, and it's only a guess, is that this comes out of the disappointment of General Wayne Downing, who was the chairman, the leader of Bush's anti-terrorism program, and whose office wanted to mount a CIA-led Northern Alliance-like war against Iraq without U.S. forces directly involved. So here we have this practically an X-ray of what we expect to do with 250,000 troops. And my guess would be that it came out of the disappointments of the general.
We have to read these reports with a certain amount of critical skepticism, eh, Jack?
Well, you do. I mean, they're leaked for a reason. And whether this was leaked to bluff Saddam Hussein or, well, Ted Williams didn't get a chance to...
Come on, Jack, you've got to say something sweet about Ted Williams. You watched him play.
Well, you know, he grew up a lonely kid in San Diego. His mother worked for the Salvation Army, and his salvation was hitting. And he gave the world delight in it.
Thank you very much, Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Have a good weekend. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.